The Reuter Fiasco. Even before his forthcoming European tour of 1873, the Shah and Monsieur Adolet hoped to accelerate modernization projects by attracting European capital. The outcome, the granting and then repeal of the Reuter concession, 1871 to 1873, proved a bizarre episode, driven as much by the Qajar Shah and his statesmen's naivete and bewilderment in their first direct experience of Europe as by their greed. It also displayed a brazen example of European profiteering in the early age of capital venture and acquiring unbridled concessions. Only through massive investment by European private capital, Iran's chief minister argued, would Iran ever be able to leap forward to be counted among the world's advanced nations. He and his chief collaborator, Mirza Malcolm Khan, focused on an investment proposal that was tabled by a well-known communications magnate of his time, Baron Julius de Reuter. Reuter was a shrewd and persuasive German-born immigrant to England who made his fortune in the early days of telegraphic telecommunication and had bought his title from a duke of a defunct minor German principality. In 1851, Reuters, one of the first modern news agencies, and one of the most enduring, began to transmit stock market quotes between London and Paris. By the early 1870s, Reuter had expanded his operation worldwide while fortifying his connections to men of money and influence in his adopted country. His appetite for investing in Iran seems to have been whetted by the successful operation of the British-owned Indo-European Telegraph Department. He understood Iran's strategic potential as a railroad link between India and Europe, but he also sensed the Shah's rush to secure a purchasable piece of European progress. He saw profit in both opportunities. The 1869 completion of the Suez Canal was hailed worldwide as a major engineering marvel made possible through private financing. By July 1872, when the Reuter concession, a monopoly on construction of a railway line and other development projects in Iran, was finally signed after a remarkably short span of secret negotiations, the level of fascination with Europe's technological advances and its financial power easily overrode any scepticism in and outside of Iranian government circles. With virtually no chance for debate, even within elite circles, the Royal Advisory Council, consisting of mostly pro-reform statesmen, ratified the unbelievably generous concession. It was taken for granted that Iranians could neither raise the capital nor master the technology to undertake a project of such a scale. Beyond the inferiority complex of the Iranian negotiators, however, there were more important ulterior motives. A few, including the Premier and Malcolm Khan, had received substantial bribes from Julius de Reuter, who had spent £200,000, $1,100,000, in advance to lubricate the granting of the concession. The sweeping terms granted a 70-year concession to the person of Reuter for the construction of a single-track trans-Iranian railroad, with its direction still to be decided, possibly from the port of Bushehr in the Persian Gulf to the port of Anzali at the Caspian Sea. In exchange, the government of Iran agreed to offer enormous facilities to Reuter unconditionally, including all the public and privately owned land and property required, as well as labour and security free of any taxes, customs, or other dues. Moreover, the Qajar state granted to Reuter what amounted to exploitation of all of Iran's natural resources and its future economic and financial potential for the duration of the concession. This included a monopoly on the exploration and development of all of Iran's mines and minerals, forests, underground and surface water resources, and all future industrial and infrastructural developments such as the telegraph, urban transportation, steelworks, textile mills, and other industries, as well as a monopoly commission on all of Iran's customs for 25 years. It further allowed the concessionaire to establish modern banks, including issuing Iranian banknotes and the right to change, at some future time, the base of Iran's metal-backed currency from silver to gold. Reuter reserved all rights to transfer, sell, or let to whomever and whatever entity he wished all or part of the above monopolies. He would pay 20% annually of the net railroad income and 15% on all other monopolies. And, of course, Reuter would provide the Shah with a loan for his forthcoming European visit. The only redeeming feature was that the concessionaire was obliged to start construction within 15 months of the signing of the concession or risk its cancellation. The whole enterprise sounded nothing short of an outrageous swindle. Reuter had yet to raise any of the £6 million in capital on the volatile European stock markets that he was obligated to provide by issuing public shares. No one in his right mind would purchase such shares, except, of course, for the Iranian government, who had agreed to pay a minimum of 7% interest and principal on Reuter's capital. Besides, since Reuter's company had virtually no technical expertise in any of the areas of the concession, he was bound to subcontract or otherwise auction off or rent out nearly all of his monopolies, a fact that cast further doubt on the success of the operation. The British Foreign Office and most of the English establishment were the least convinced. Only concession hunters across Europe, who had already managed to bring Egypt, the Ottoman Empire, and Tunisia to the verge of bankruptcy, and the African coast safari slave hunters of earlier times, who bartered copper wire and looking glasses for slaves, must have marvelled at Reuter's scheme and laughed at Nasser ad-Din Shah, his modernising premier, and the 8 high-ranking ministers and dignitaries who put their seals of approval on the concession. What blinded these otherwise seasoned officials and led them to believe they had struck a good deal was complex. In part, it was their sycophantic desire to give the Shah what he wanted, namely the necessary funds for his European tour, which also included many of them in the retinue. They had let themselves, moreover, be bamboozled by Reuter's negotiator, and the argument that because Iran could not afford the necessary security to guarantee the railroad project, the only alternative was to pay it through monopolies. Not before reaching St. Petersburg, however, did the Shah realize the gravity of his blunder. The Russian authorities, including Tsar Alexander II himself, in no uncertain terms, confidentially warned the Shah that the concession was diametrically opposed to Russian interests, not least because it gave the British access to the Caspian and thus to Russian frontiers. By the time he reached London, the Shah had serious second thoughts. Snubbing Reuter was an early sign of what was to come. On the Shah's return home in September 1873, resistance to the concession among the Qajar princes, his favourite wife, Anisa Dole, elements in the palace, and some of the Tehran ulama, was so vehement that upon arriving at the port of Anzali, the Shah had to immediately dismiss Mashir al-Dole. To preempt further trouble, Mashir al-Dole was temporarily appointed governor of Gilan and instructed to stay there. Once the immediate threat of a palace revolt subsided, the Shah summoned back Mashir al-Dole, reappointed him as Minister of Affairs, and instructed him to immediately repeal the concession. The Shah's concern with the conservative faction required circumspection at first and a balancing act afterward. The sum total of counterbalancing the conservatives and the progressives meant a loss of momentum for Mashir al-Dole and a tangible slowdown for the reform measures. A master negotiator and a flatterer toward his royal master, Mashir al-Dole argued long and hard with Reuter's representatives that since they had not started the railroad construction project within the first 15 months, the concession was automatically cancelled. To the British Foreign Office, lukewarm in its support of Reuter, he justified the repeal by recalling the usual ghost of Russian reprisal. By 1874, it seemed that, at least for the time being, Reuter no longer had a case. Yet he was a man of perseverance who patiently awaited opportunities and doggedly nurtured the support of the British authorities. Nasser ad-Din, who anxiously asked for and received the original copy of the Reuter concession to strike it out with his own hand as null and void, must have realized that long after Mashir al-Dole, he again would have to face the claims of the shrewd concessionaire, this time under British pressure. After 16 years had passed, Reuter eventually succeeded in securing a new concession on the grounds of the original for the creation of the Imperial Bank of Persia to issue banknotes on behalf of the Iranian government. Reuter's company also again received the monopoly to develop all of Iran's unused mine and mineral resources. Iran's first experience with large-scale Western capital bore all the marks of unreserved exploitation. One redeeming point, however, was the degree of resistance to the concession. Even if the Shah and most of his pro-reform advisers were intimidated by the material power and glamour of the West, there were some who voiced criticism and persuaded the Shah to change course. The motives of princes of the royal family and their associates during the palace revolt were mostly hostility toward Mushir al-Dowleh, in part because of his open homosexual orientation, but also his modernizing scheme. They shared grievances with a handful of high-ranking ulama, who felt that a railroad and such Western-style developments would open the way to the Farangis and corrupt the faith of the Iranians. Yet their argument was not based entirely on the demerits of imitating Westerners. Chief among them, Mala Ali Khani, the influential mujtahid of the capital, in a reproachful letter to the Shah, criticized the Reuter concession not because it robbed Iran of its economic sovereignty, but for the provisions in the concession that violated private ownership, contrary to Islamic law. The ulama's defiance of Europe's economic intrusion had to wait for another 2 decades before it would flare up during the tobacco protest. By the late 1870s, Mushir al-Dowleh's high hopes for transforming Iran had run aground. The state bureaucracy and diplomatic corps grew in size, but despite the introduction of Western-style ministries and attempts to rationalize the government machinery, such measures did not greatly improve efficiency or accountability. Finance, military, and the judiciary remained almost unchanged. The old elite's inertia effectively offset any serious overhaul. Efforts to introduce modern education and a relatively free press and publication proved short-lived. That a skilled statesman with 20 years of experience abroad should have made a blunder as evident as Reuter concession, which tarnished Mushir al-Dowleh's image even in his own time, remains a mystery. Tilting toward the British as a counter to an impending Russian threat may be one motive. One cannot rule out his wide-eyed rush for a wholesale purchase of modernity either, not unusual to many modernizers of his period, intoxicated with the myth of European progress. Yet Mushir al-Dowleh may also have been driven by greed, and other instances of graft marred his career. In this respect, he was not an exception to the rule, as many Qajar statesmen used their high offices to acquire wealth as a security against their many occupational hazards. By November 1881, when he died in Mashhad at the age of 53, he was serving as a trustee of the shrine of the 8th Imam in Mashhad. His death under suspicious circumstances may well have been carried out by administration of the venomous Qajar coffee, Kaveh-e Qajar, which was a swift and quiet method preferred by Nasr al-Din to rid unwanted officials who had fallen victim to his suspicion or grudge. Afterward, there was little appreciation for him and his services from the Qajar establishment, and nothing but apathy from the Shah, not unlike what had happened with Amir Kabir 3 decades earlier. Upon hearing the news of Mushir al-Dowleh's death, Muhammad Hasan Khan Etemad al-Sultaneh, the Shah's astute confidant and dragoman, observed in his secret diaries on November 15, 1881, "Despite all his deplorable habits, he, Mushir al-Dowleh, was wise and shrewd and aware of political stratagem, politic, and European customs. If the Shah hadn't turned him mad with undue promotion, he would have been the best servant of the government. But within 1 year the Shah first made him the Justice Minister, then the War Minister, and then the Chief Minister, and the latter with such an autonomy as if the very office of kingship was delegated to him. That is what made him mad and arrogant. Today the Shah was saying, 'He offended me much. This man had reached a stage that there was no way out for him but to die. He put us into much trouble. He almost behaved like Midhat Pasha.' What the Shah meant was treason toward his royal benefactor." The reference to Midhat Pasha was not mere coincidence. Only a few months earlier, in April 1881, Sultan Abdul Hamid had arrested the celebrated reformer and architect of the 1876 Ottoman constitution, put him on trial, and condemned him to death on the unproven charge of the murder of Sultan Abdulaziz. Less than 3 years later, Midhat was executed. Nasr al-Din Shah, who was well aware of the friendship of the two statesmen, must have feared a similar fate at the hand of his former chief minister. The doomed Mushir el-Dowle was the fourth chief minister to fall victim to the Shah's paranoid fears. As it was the royal practice, the Shah soon appropriated all of Mushir el-Dowle's possessions, including his Baharistan mansion, designed in 1880 by a French-educated Iranian architect in grand Baroque style. It was adjacent to the still incomplete Nasseri complex, the trusteeship of which Mushir el-Dowle had offered to Nasser ad-Din Shah out of a mix of fear and devotion. The Shah granted the use of the mansion to his own favourite page-boy, Malijak, which in Kurdish means little sparrow. He was also known as Aziz el-Sultan, the favourite of the king, an ultimate affront to the deceased minister. The Baharistan mansion later became the seat of the Majlis, the Iranian parliament, during the constitutional revolution and after. Mushir el-Dowle's decade-long era marked the third and final attempt of Nasser ad-Din Shah to undertake reform in a serious and systematic fashion. The limited success once more revealed the structural barriers in the way of transforming the state and the economy of the country. While the vacillating Shah saw his own survival in playing off factions within the Qajar polity, the entrenched conservative nobility and ulama class remained deeply suspicious of European-style reforms. Refashioning the capital. If the Shah consciously stayed away from the import of major state institutions and political culture, far more than his Ottoman and Egyptian counterparts had, he was eager to absorb and adopt symbols of Europe's material culture. Unlike technology and industrialization, which were hard to import, material culture and luxury commodities travelled well. And it was these, rather than Europe's industrial and political achievements, that first left their mark on Iran's urban life, culture, and artistic expressions. They served as physical projections of Qajar power and its quest for grandeur, pleasing changes that could elevate the image of the Shah as a progressive, on par with his Ottoman and European counterparts. The Qajars were always good builders, as evident in the numerous palaces, gardens, and public buildings constructed under Fath Ali Shah and later. In the same vein, the Nasseri era, from the late 1860s on, witnessed an unprecedented urban revival, partly under Mushir el-Dowle. Princes and statesmen, as well as tribal khans, wealthy merchants and mujtahids, built sizable residences and private gardens and created charitable endowments, including mosques, madrasas, caravanserais, bazaars, ganats, bridges, bathhouses, and water reservoirs. Examples of Nasseri age construction that survived ravages of later Pahlavi modernity are examples of great architectural endeavours that express serenity and delicateness. As may be expected, the first changes in style appeared in the architecture and decoration of Golestan Palace. The great reception hall, Talar-e-Salam, perhaps the most significant interior court architecture of the late Qajar period, was in part inspired by the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, which it shared with Dolmabahce Palace in Istanbul, but built at a smaller scale and with an exquisite taste, indicative of the technical and architectural abilities of Qajar master builders. The adjacent Mirror Hall obviously alluded to Versailles, but was decorated with elaborate Persian mirror tilework. As part of his construction program, Nasser ad-Din restored or reconstructed earlier royal buildings in the Golestan complex as well. Even before the Shah's European tour in 1873, the new Perso-European style had appeared in the five-story Shams-el-Amare, Sun of the Palaces, in the Golestan complex, with a view of the capital's panorama. Completed in 1867, possibly with the Safavid Ali Kapu in mind, construction was supervised by the chief of royal palaces, Dust Ali Khan Ma'ayyer al-Mamalek, a descendant of a family of masters of the royal mint with roots in the Safavid era. It was built by Ali Muhammad Kashani, a master builder who, presumably for the first time in Iran, used a steel frame in a multi-story building. The design was meant to evoke a house of amusement reminiscent of the stories of the Seven Domes, Haft Gonbad, a well-known romance by the 12th-century Persian poet Nezami Ganjavi. Atop the building was a clock tower housing a massive two-faced clock a gift from Queen Victoria, which invited the people of the capital to keep time accurately. Poor maintenance and complaints from the women of the harem, though, soon brought the clock to a standstill, a sign the Qajar era was more accustomed to its own dawn-to-dusk timekeeping than the disciplined timekeeping of the state. In addition to the Golestan complex, the late Nasiri age witnessed the building of at least 8 other palaces and numerous royal gardens in and around the capital. The Palace of Eshratabad, literally Abode of Indulgence, on the eastern side of the capital, was Nasiruddin Shah's version of Jardin d'Amour. The Sultanatabad Summer Palace, first built in 1850 to the north of the capital, was lavishly restored and rededicated in 1878 as Sahib Karnier to celebrate the 13th anniversary of Nasiruddin's reign. The Palace of Shahr-e-Stanak, now demolished, was built high in the Elbers, overlooking Tehran and the Farahabad Garden Palace on the eastern outskirts of the capital, known as Qasr-e-Firuzeh, an expanded version of the Royal Hunting Lodge. The remarkable Takiyeh-e-Dolat, the state hall designed to perform the mourning ceremonies of Mahram, was another landmark of the Nasiri age. Commissioned by the Shah in 1868, its building was supervised by Mayaher al-Mamalek, and its design, in the style of European opera houses, benefited from the advice of the Frenchman Jules Richard, once a French teacher to Nasser ad-Din, and later a teacher at Dar al-Funun and an antique dealer. The design of Tekieh, with its massive hall, steel-framed semi-permanent dome, arched private balconies, several lower-level seats for city folk, and circular center stage, was particularly designed for the performance of Shi'i passion plays known as Ta'ziyeh. The royal edifice was in sharp contrast to the modest sites where Ta'ziyeh was usually performed in towns and villages throughout the country. In this state-owned Tekieh, too, under one roof, the Qajar elite gathered along with ordinary men and women of the city to witness, for free, not only the most elaborate Ta'ziyeh in town, but also the Shah in person, to marvel at his state's great symbol of devotion to Shi'i martyrs. Greatly appreciated by the Qajar public and by the elite, the staging of the tragedies of Karbala was an old tradition that went back at least to the 10th century. The art of Ta'ziyeh involved the melodic recitation of rhymed set verses, both by protagonists and by antagonists, use of wind and percussion instruments, costumes in the Arab style of the 7th century, horses and camels, and a great deal of dramatic, often bloody, action. No doubt the performative aspect of the Ta'ziyeh was a motivation for the construction of an elaborate state Tekieh. Not only members of the diplomatic corps in the Qajar court were invited to attend the performance, the Ta'ziyeh of the Qajar era also included in the cast an imaginary delegation from the land of Farang, which toward the end of the performance offered its support and sympathies for the anguished Imam Hussein. There was, however, an entertaining aspect of the performance, and to lighten the mood of religious tragedies at times, the court clowns performed comedies in the state Tekieh. Through the medium of architecture, Qajar Iran borrowed and internalized Occidental concepts and technologies while preserving Persian character and function. Beside constructions in the citadel, Arg, and other royal complexes, the most significant development was the expansion of the capital, including the construction of new city walls, modern thoroughfares, European-style stores, and, a decade later, a horse-driven tramway with 3 lines and many stops. By the 1870s, the 4.5 miles of Tehran's old city walls, first built by the Safavid Shah Tahmasp in the 16th century and reinforced by Fath Ali Shah, could no longer house the city's growing population, which had reached more than 150,000. By 1900, Tehran's population had reached about 200,000. The old Tehran consisted of 4 wards, Mahalleh, a royal citadel, and 6 city grates, but the new city walls, which took 10 years to complete, encompassed 12 miles surrounding 5 wards, each of which had numerous quarters, Patug. No fewer than 12 city gates had handsome designs and Persian tilework, with designs invoking the signs of zodiac and in honor of the 12 Shi'i imams. According to a survey of the capital completed in 1853, there were 7,872 houses and 4,220 shops and businesses in Tehran. By 1867, the total population of 147,256 resided in 9,581 houses. 68% owned their house and 32% were tenants. By 1900, the number of houses had grown to 16,275, with 9,420 shops and businesses, a growth of roughly 45% from 1853. The 1853 survey also identified that 2,580 of the houses, or 32% of them, belonged to government employees. 20 of these were large complexes consisting of four or more units, which housed the extended families of senior officials. Of the 5,844 houses belonging to civilians, some 95% were Shi'i Muslims. 96 houses belonged to 180 Armenian households and 129 houses to 134 Jewish families. By 1867, there were some 130 European families residing in the capital. A typical house of the Nasseri era sheltered an extended family of three or more generations. But even smaller houses belonging to the urban middle class improved in quality and size. An affluent Qajar household included a sizable number of domestic workers, cooks and gardeners, as well as male and female slaves, often from Zanzibar or Abyssinia, who had been in Iran for generations and had their own families. According to 1867 statistics, more than 17,000 people, or 11.5% of the total population of Tehran, belonged to the servant, Nokar, class, attached to 9,581 houses, and among them, 10,568 were servants, 3,802 were domestic workers, and 3,014 were slaves. These servants and slaves almost entirely were attached to or resided in households of the nobility, ranking officials, large landowners, merchants, and affluent ulama. Yet outside the small but very prosperous urban elite, discrepancies in wealth among the rest of the population were not that extreme, even including the immigrant population of the city. In 1867, even before the physical expansion of the capital, immigrants from the provinces, mostly Azerbaijan, Isfahan, and Kashan, constituted 71% of Tehran's population. The statistics on public spaces is also noticeable. The survey of Tehran in 1867 counted 47 mosques, 35 madrasas, and 34 tekkies, as well as 190 public bathhouses, 130 caravanserais, and 20 ice makers, yakhchal. By 1900, there were 80 mosques and madrasas, 43 tekkies, 182 public bathhouses, 184 caravanserais, and 24 ice makers. The 1900 statistics also identified 7 churches, 2 synagogues, 7 barracks, 2 hospitals, 2 government schools, and 215 gardens and orchards in and around the city. Almost in all areas, perhaps with the exception of mosques and madrasas, Tehran witnessed steady urban growth, indicative of its political centrality, even though provincial centres such as Tabriz, Mashhad, and Yazd still held an economic and demographic edge over the capital. Such a diversity of functions, which remained in place until the early decades of the 20th century, was a hallmark of the decentralized Qajar system. Yet, as part of Tehran's urban development, municipal services began to emerge in the latter part of the 19th century. Nasiruddin Shah created a small sanitation department responsible for removal of unsightly rubbish from street corners. The leaders of the city wards continued to serve under the city mayor, but were overshadowed by the capital's office of governor under Kamran Mirza, Nasiruddin Shah's younger son. The newly created post of chief of police, held by an Italian officer with a dubious claim to nobility, overlooked a growing force that came to replace the old policing style in the wards and the bazaar. With the Italian police chief arrived new police administration and new methods of surveillance and control. Wary of anti-Qajar dissent in the final decades of the 19th century, the police force, under the supervision of Kamran Mirza, created a rudimentary secret police responsible for rounding up dissidents among officials, intellectuals, and the Barbies. Overall, Tehran's modernization project was extensive, but not as much as that of Cairo, the so-called Paris on the Nile under the Khadiv Ismail, or of Istanbul under Sultan Abd al-Majid and his successors. Nor was it as westernized as those cities in style and construction. Much of old Tehran remained intact up until the 1920s and 1930s, as was the case for other Iranian cities, perhaps with the exception of a handful of Western-style structures, such as missionary schools and hospitals, that were built in Tabriz and Isfahan. The old streets and alleys, forming a network that crisscrossed through the city wards and meandered between houses and gardens, were seldom paved or laid with stone. Instead, passers-by had to negotiate their way through the mud and dirt of the narrow streets. It would still be another half-century, though, before the Western notion of the urban grid would ruin the fabric of the old city. A few modern avenues built in the Nasseri era, as early as the 1860s, cut through the old wards, but seldom disturbed the coherence of the city's original space. Most visible among the new developments was Nasseri Avenue, north of the bazaar and west of the Citadel complex. Both sides of the wide thoroughfare were lined with shops offering goods and commodities not available inside the bazaar. Further north, Lalehzar Avenue connected the Arg through Meydane Mashk, Drill Square, in the older part of the city, to the newly developed Dolat Ward and the northern outskirts of the city. It was the first for-profit housing and shopping project developed by Nasiruddin Shah himself. As a shortage of empty land within the city walls raised prices, the Shah saw an opportunity to turn Lalehzar, meaning tulip field, a delightful royal garden built by Fath Ali Shah, into a moneymaker for his ever-hungry royal purse. It remained the most fashionable sector of the capital well into the 20th century. The 1853 survey identified 113 trades and professions in Tehran. Almost all were traditional wholesale and retail occupations based either in the central bazaar or in neighborhood shopping alleys. A similar pattern was also in place in major provincial centers. Only in the latter decades of the century, though, did shops and businesses offering Western luxury goods gradually appear in the newly developed streets of the capital. Although European woolen and cotton fabrics and some metalwares were popular since the 1840s, the number and variety of Western goods, such as china, glassware, and women's toiletries, were negligible even at the turn of the 20th century. Mashir al-Dowleh's construction of the massive Nasseri Mosque and Madrasa complex east of the capital soon became a landmark. Built in the seven-dome Haft-Kaseh style between 1878 and 1883, it was a testimony to the achievements of late Qajar architecture. Aimed to introduce a reformed curriculum and teaching method to Shi'i madrasa education, the Nasseri Madrasa held one of the richest libraries of Islamic manuscripts in Iran, including rare scientific and geographical texts. Many private collections belonging to the Qajar nobility were closed to the public, and numerous libraries in the shrines and madrasas, such as the valuable collection in the shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad, were limited to teachers and students. And because the royal library at Golestan Palace, with a rich manuscript collection going back to the 13th century, was for the Shah's private use, and the small library of Dar al-Funun was largely for teaching purposes, the Nasseri Library was the closest concept to a public library in the Nasseri era. Trading centers all over Iran also witnessed a degree of expansion and improvement. Mansions built in innovative styles housed members of the provincial elite. In Kashan, Yazd, and Isfahan, merchants and landowners built numerous grand houses with revenue from the tobacco, opium, and textile trades. Kashan merchant families in particular thrived in the latter decades of the century, and in addition to their mansions, built new alleys and bazaars, caravanserais, mosques, and water reservoirs. Narrating Europe, Real and Imaginary. The Persianizing of European styles was also evident in other areas of material culture throughout the latter part of the 19th century. A sense of confidence in freely adopting and adapting is notable in painting and the decorative arts, popular stories, music and performance, the introduction of new foods, dresses and cosmetics, urban planning and beautification, garden designs, and new plants and flowers. Arguably, the most Persian of all cultural expressions, poetry, also began to experience new form and content. These cultural adaptations did not imply bowing to Europe's imperial power. Contrary to what purists often claim, art and architecture of the Qajar period were neither decadent nor bastardized replicas of European archetypes. Rather, they emerged out of a period of cultural fluorescence, which displayed a distinct Persian taste. The works of Abul Hasan Ghafari, with the title of Sani al-Mulch, the great painter and graphic artist of the period, is but one example. Born in 1814 to an old family of great artists and statesmen from Kashan, he was trained in the Isfahan school of portraiture before developing his own technique and perspective. He visited Italy in the mid-1840s to be trained in the European style and returned a few years later with a nuanced view of Western art, more socially contextualized than any other Iranian artist of his time. After he visited Italy, his choice of subject matter diversified without being overwhelmed by the European masters, although he did copy a few works for practice and for teaching purposes. Upon his return to Iran in 1851, just after Amir Kabir's downfall, and as part of the former premier's patronage of Persian arts and crafts, Abul Hasan established the first modern studio in the newly founded Dar al-Sanayeh, House of Crafts, complex in the Tehran Bazaar. Besides promoting painting, Dar al-Sanayeh was a notable attempt, possibly inspired by Safavid royal workshops, to preserve and promote Persian handicrafts and small industries such as textiles, carpet weaving, lacquer work, bookbinding, mosaics and silverworks, as well as modern crafts such as manufacturing horse carriages. In his studio, Sani al-Mulch displayed his copies of the European masters Raphael, Michelangelo and Titian, as well as classical Greek torsos. He admitted apprentices to work in the new style and every Friday invited the public to view the new artwork. He gave instruction not only in drawing and painting, but also in graphic arts, the printing press, and lithography, and he accepted orders for lithographic reproductions. Illustrating the famous 1001 Nights, Hezar o Yek Shab, a collection of Indo-Persian and Arabian stories, sometimes known in the West as the Arabian Nights, was one early achievement. In 1851, he was commissioned by Nasr ad-Din Shah, under the patronage of Ma'ayer al-Mamalek, to illustrate a royal copy of the text, which a talented writer and a poet jointly had translated from Arabic into Persian around the same time. This was perhaps the greatest artistic project of the post-Safavid period, and one of the most notable in the 19th century Muslim world. Supervising 34 assistants and apprentices in his workshop, not including calligraphers, bookbinders, and illuminators, for a period of 3 years, Sani al-Mulch created a 6-volume manuscript consisting of 3,600 watercolor illustrations on 1,134 pages. He was paid the hefty sum of 6,582 mans, almost $65,000, for the commission. Sani al-Mulch's artistic creativity is evident in his realist style, which had been unknown to the Persian tradition of illuminated books. He placed the scenes of 1001 Nights not in an imaginary era of the Baghdad Caliphate, but in his own time and surroundings. He used the ancient tale to comment on Qajar society and politics, making subtle allusions to contemporary personalities and events. Everyday life in the bazaar and the street, dress, food, musical instruments, transportation, and, of course, Europeans, were the subjects of many of the illustrations. He highlighted the private life of women, servants, slaves and eunuchs, as well as leisure, entertainment, dancing and drinking, and he presented daring illustrations of love and sexuality. To make the narratives more accessible and relevant, he used bright colors and dynamic designs, almost bordering on caricature. The illustrated manuscript, preserved in the library of Golestan Palace, was only viewable by the Shah and his courtiers, and was never published, a sad fate of artistic works with royal patronage, even in the age of printing. The same spirit of acerbic humour is evident in a number of Sani al-Mulch's watercolours with social themes. the complex scene of a brawl in Tabriz involving lootees, or an odd bunch of court attendants surrounding a dandy Qajar prince, or a group of ludicrous court hangers-on. These were critical commentaries on violence, greed, and the absurdity of the Qajar court, all wrapped up with a fresh wit. As the editor of the Government Gazette, Sani Al-Mulch introduced for the first time sketches and cartoons of daily crime scenes and urban unrest, as well as royal parades, horse races and hunts, often with subtle references to social undercurrents of the time. It is probable that his critical eye caused a fallout with the Qajar establishment shortly before his mysterious death in 1866 at the age of 54, perhaps another victim of the notorious Qajar coffee. Later painters of the Nasseri period continued in the Perso-European hybrid style, with great innovations. The works of Mahmud Khan Kashani Malek al-Shoara not only captured the delicacy of the royal architecture of his time, but also arrived at a novel expressionist style. Works of Mahmud Ghafari Kashani, better known as Kamal al-Mulch, 1859-1940, a relative of Sani al-Mulch, in contrast, was directly inspired by European realism of his time. His scenery and portrayal work, much admired by Nasser ad-Din Shah, proved more influential in the development of Persian painting in the early 20th century. By the time of the Constitutional Revolution, there was a visible shift toward European realism and away from the artistic innocence of the earlier period. Pictorial traits, characteristic of Persian cultural identity, nevertheless remained strong. Likewise, the music of the Nasseri period, mostly under court patronage, paved the way for the efflorescence of the Persian classical Radif system around the time of the Constitutional Revolution. The Persian popular imagination also explored Farang and its exotic delights. The humorous romance of Amir Arsalan Rumi, a popular adventure yarn bridging old Persian folktales with the modern novel, reflected an ambivalence toward Europe between seduction and violence. Narrated by Muhammad Ali Naqib al-Mamalek, the chief storyteller, Nagal, of the court, to Nasser ad-Din Shah as his bedtime entertainment, the adventurous story evidently appealed to women of the royal harem. Tuman Aga Fakhr al-Dole, a gifted daughter of the Shah, who transcribed the story while being narrated by the storyteller, apparently also illustrated it. Once the printed editions came out, as early as 1898, the novel not only appealed to the literate public, but also became part of the Nagal's repertoire. In the story, Amir Arsalan is an orphaned prince whose father was slain and whose Rum kingdom, the Ottoman Empire, was attacked and occupied by forces of the powerful Petrus Shah, a king of Farang, perhaps an allusion to Peter the Great of Russia. In revenge, Amir Arsalan, who had been brought up in Egypt, recaptures Rum and ascends to the throne. In the bloody campaign of cleansing Istanbul of all Christian churches and priests, he discovers a portrait of Farouk Laga, Blessed Countenance, the dazzling daughter of Petrus Shah, and immediately falls in love with her. A handsome, hot-headed youth with a taste for Christian blood, Amir Arsalan abandons his kingdom in search of his beloved to arrive incognito in the perilous land of Farang. There, with the help of secret Muslim converts in high offices, he eventually meets Farouk Laga, who also had seen Amir Arsalan's picture and fallen in love with him. Working as a bartender in the theatre, Amir Arsalan, who fluently speaks several languages of the land of Farang, becomes involved in a series of escapades that lands him in a magical world of demons and fairies, where, after many adventures, he eventually rescues his beloved and returns with her to the land of Farang. Impressed with Amir Arsalan's valour and devotion, Petrus Shah is obliged to allow the couple to get married. Amir Arsalan returns to his seat of power, Farouk Laga is duly transferred to the harem, and peace is restored between the two kingdoms. While drenched in mindless violence, the story is also coloured with hilarious dialogue, sentimental romance, and childish antics. Such material was meant to entertain the Shah, and later on readers and the coffeehouse audiences, and to satisfy their curiosity about Europe. Such fanciful Persianizing of Europe as a hostile yet seductive realm may be read as symptomatic of Iran's conflicting aspirations. A Layli and Majnun, or English Romeo and Juliet, paradigm of the amorous hero falling in love with the chaste beauty from a hostile land. Yet, contrary to the languishing Majnun of medieval romance, Amir Arsalan embodies all Iranian aspirations for power, virility, and success, even though he is an Ottoman prince born in Egypt. Another fictional character of the period displayed the other side of the dilemma of incorporating Western modernity. Ibrahim Berg's Travelogue is a realistic novel by Zain al-Abidin Maraghehi, an Iranian emigre merchant who spent most of his life in the Caucasus, Russia, and the Ottoman Empire. Based on the author's own experiences, the novel narrates the story of a young and idealistic merchant of Azerbaijani origin whose glorified perception of Iran is rudely shattered once he visits his ancestral homeland. Ibrahim Beg is a prosperous, widely travelled and educated man with lofty moral values and wholesome Shi'i faith. He is deeply pained by the decay, corruption and backwardness his country suffers from, and aspires to bring to it material progress, social justice, and moral reconstruction. Yet, at every turn, he faces intransigence. Maraghehi's account, an excellent example of the simple prose of the late Nasseri period, is a passionate litany on the flaws of the Iranian state and society, as voiced by a Babi sympathizer. Unlike Nasser ad-Din's rather nonchalant attitude, Ibrahim Beg's encounter with the West makes him see the weaknesses of his own society, state, and culture. He further observes Iran's economic stagnation and lack of investments, as well as the poverty of the majority in contrast to the wealth of a few, recurring famines and starvation, and diseases. He comments on the growth of petty crimes and an unproductive culture of peddling and usury. In particular, he notices a lack of public hygiene in bathhouses, the scarcity of modern medication, and an absence of modern hospitals. The financial chaos and mismanagement, the scarcity of money in the market, and non-existence of modern financial institutions such as banks, all incense the author. He is also troubled with lack of modern industries and modern road communication, disinterest in exploring Iran's rich mineral resources, the tragic destruction of Iran's forests, unemployment, mass migration to neighboring countries in search of menial jobs, lack of planning and statistics, and absence of standardized weights and measures. Like most non-Western, reform-minded writers of the late 19th century, he laments the lack of modern education and Western-style schools and secular curricula, for which he blames the conservative clerical establishment. He held the Qajar elite, along with the ulama, responsible for Iran's chronic weaknesses and its curse of being subordinate to superior powers. Domestic culprits aside, there was little blame on the Western powers' territorial and economic exploits. Typically, he does not foresee a chance of the West respecting Iran's sovereignty or caring for its well-being, so long as the state and the people are in their deep slumber and do not wake to care for themselves. Ibrahim Beg's critical outlook is, of course, complemented by a conscious sense of patriotism and a love for his homeland, for its glorious past and a desire to reconstruct it again, a viewpoint no doubt idealized by the author's long years residing abroad. Here we see the crux of an Iranian bourgeois ethos aspiring to reconcile adopted modernity with Perso-Shi'i identity, a trait that was to be sharpened with the Constitutional Revolution. Not surprisingly, in the wake of the Constitutional Revolution, Ibrahim Beg's imaginary travels were widely appreciated in the pre-revolutionary secret societies of the time.